outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gen. The God Gen. The God Gen.
Help me, Kyle. Help me.
Help you?
Yeah, when this airs, man, I'm going to be on my way to an airport.
Oh, for the first time in a long time.
13 months, yeah, since I've had to go to LAX and crawl on a plane. And I'm not worried about the pandemic aspects of that travel at all. I just, because we're vaccinated and I'll be masked and all that good stuff. But,
yep.
Man, I just thinking about navigating airports again, having to pack, get up early, head down to the airport. It's a lifestyle I've got unaccustomed to.
Now, did they grandfather you in your ultra platinum VIP flying passes that you were up to for having a certain number of miles?
Well, interestingly enough, the year before the pandemic hit, I finally crossed my 1,000,000 mile marker with United, which means I have lifetime status with United, whether I fly or not. So yeah.
Okay.
So I didn't even have to get grandfathered in. I'm just in. I'm in for the rest of my life, and I got to bring my wife in. It doesn't have any porks right now with it, but yeah, I may get an upgrade or something. Who knows?
How do you feel about getting on a plane again?
Just the hassles of travel. I never mind flying. I'm not worried about, you know, airplanes going down or anything like that. although that may happen one day. Who knows? But they do occasionally, but it's very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited to go see some people. And then after, I'm going to be in Amarillo helping with a college there, deal with some things. And then I got to come back to Denver anyway. So I'm going to hop off and spend a couple of days with my son. So I'm looking forward to that.
Nice. Do you guys have any plans?
I don't know. It's going to depend on the weather. And it's snowing right now in Denver. So it's hard to say what we'll be able to do. He was talking about playing golf or something, but I'm just looking forward to hanging out with him. And
well, I can tell you that there's hope on the horizon. It's supposed to be in the 70s by the end of the week. So
I'm watching that. Hopefully it comes to pass. Anyway, your wife had a rough day.
She did. Yeah, she'd been having some repeated sinus infections and strep, and come to find out her tonsils were a carrier of the strep virus.
Oh.
Didn't know that was a thing. She had to go in and have her tonsils removed, a deviated septum fixed.
So she's recovering tonight.
She is a hurting customer this evening.
Bless her heart. My goodness. That's something you ought to have done when you're 5 or 6. That way you never have to think about it. But
yes.
I still have my tonsils, so hopefully.
So do I.
Hopefully I get to keep them. I'm Wayne Jacobson.
I'm Kyle Rice.
And this is the God Journey. I'm going to start with a voicemail I got yesterday, as a matter of fact. And this one really touched me. So why don't I just play the voicemail for you, and we'll come back and talk about it.
I just listened to your Settled in the Spirit, really. And I know you've experienced, and we've experienced this kind of thing. But really, I thought I was one of the only ones that was experiencing almost word for word various things that you spoke, including and especially this rest and settledness and trust and playfulness, and God's delight in us, and us learning how to delight in Him, and this thing about creation. I thought I was the only one. I've not even known how to pursue some of the stuff that I'm sensing and feeling. And so you have to know my heart's jumping for joy just to know that we're walking the path together. And it's not based on our conversations or talking about it. I sometimes even almost felt guilty for how well things have gone through the COVID time, how settled in the midst of turmoil, and really even cut back on sharing with some people because I knew they weren't there. I want to tell you how encouraging it is, and I'm glad I'm not the freaky alone one. There's another freaky person. And I should have expected it.
Let me tell you about this guy, Kyle. This guy I've known for probably 30 years, a denominational official, end up helping a lot of burned out pastors find their way, doing that for the denomination. Fortunately or unfortunately, he kept referring him to my material. So I've met a lot of these people that he kind of said, there may be another way to think this through when you're having trouble with the system the way it is. But man, I love that someone, I haven't probably talked to him in a year, personally. Mm-hmm. We're going to get together soon. In fact, I was in his neck of the woods last week and thought about, man, I'd love to get him for lunch, but I've got someone else with me, so I really can't stop. And but we're going to catch up. And just to hear, this is representative of a lot of conversations I'm in and emails I've received from people saying, man, I can't believe it. I had the same thing on my heart. I've had it for some time, that playfulness, rest, being inside of God without all the tension and guilt and shame, and seeing how that gives rise to the people of God being revealed in the earth. And I love what we talked about last week. I love that that's resonated with some hearts. And
yeah,
I'm like, I don't know what it means. And I don't know what it means either. I'm willing to go down this road and see what unfolds.
I love that it has just resonated with people as well. And I've been able to get a few emails and get some responses back to those as well. And just that I loved, again, the after show that we had. I got it right this time, the after show.
Not after party.
We had, and just getting to hear how it's impacting people and just where people are at with this journey and the joy that they are experiencing. And the idea of being settled in the spirit, it was one of those moments where it came out of my mouth, and then you had the audacity to come back and say, Kyle, what is that? What do you mean by that? Like, everybody's screaming, what do you mean by that? And then you put me on the spot. I'm like, well, I mean, I have a little bit of an idea, but honestly, I don't know. And I'm figuring it out.
I like too that he just, you know, because I think this will be true for a lot of people. I think there's an undercurrent of God's working where people have not been in conversations about the things Jesus is revealing to them. But even the connections God makes by saying, oh my gosh, that's exactly what's been on my heart. And I'm glad I'm not the only freaking person thinking this way. And I think that connection is big. I got an email from a guy in Canada today just saying, boy, this same stuff's been exactly on his heart. And we talked about some of that before he even listened to the podcast from last week. And they went, what is that? What are you saying? The same thing I was saying. And I said, I thought you were responding to the podcast. So I had no idea. I hadn't heard it yet, but yeah, I like it. I like not knowing what it means. I like being able to hold it loosely and say, God, show us. And we're in.
And I feel like that has to be part of it, right? Because whenever we try to grip onto it or hold onto it or try to define it or put parameters around it, that's where we get ourselves in trouble. At least I do anyway. Because I was just talking with a good some partners that I've been working with out of Wisconsin. Amazing couple, and we were just chatting and literally had the same conversation where I was coming out of the mountains, had been spending some time in prayer, and I got a hold of them, and we were literally having the same conversation. The couple were having the same conversation just about resting in this and not pushing timing, that we've got some things on our heart that we feel like God has really called us into, but enjoying the playfulness of the way that God's arranging it. Like, we could have never manufactured this stuff on our own.
Yeah.
And yet being able to just sit in relationship with God and with his beloved, with other believers, and being able to just enjoy that and being surprised by it and having fun with it. It's been a blast.
And that's okay to be in that space, even though the world around us is in some pretty tense space.
Yeah.
With the pandemic, with the racial divide, we're sitting here, the Derek Chauvin trial's kind of gotten now to the jury, or will be to the jury soon. And friends I've got in law enforcement in Los Angeles, they're on tactical alert now for the whole week because they're expecting, you know, no matter how the trial goes, there's going to be probably significant protests that slash rioting slash looting slash whatever happens. And yeah, it's okay for us to be at rest and at play in God, even as we hold in our heart the devastation of our world and the pain that people are feeling, and, you know, talking to God about those kinds of things.
And I think learning how to do this, because we've talked a little bit about that, and that it's not bound to the circumstances, right? That we could still be going through hard times and still have that sense of rest, that sense of that I'm loved, and that sense of playfulness. And yet, man, you're right. As we're on the cusp of some pretty potentially major social outbreak, it's interesting. Like, how, as we look forward to that, how do we align ourselves with God in that sense of love and that sense of rest? As you said, especially, you know, for our friends in law enforcement or our friends in the African-American community, like, what does this look like? And how do they navigate that?
Interestingly, this week, that's why I'm going to Amarillo. We're helping a college there deal with racism on their campus and deal with policies and the statement that kind of moves from racism. and anti-racist approach. And I know that makes some of my friends nervous because all they've heard about anti-racism is the critical race theory, the whole Marxist version. What we got to know, what everyone, I hope every rational person realizes, is that there are forces on the extreme right and on the extreme left that would love to have a culture war, love to have a race war in America. They would love it. And there are voices even from elected officials that are stirring the pot and making it even more contentious. And after what happened in the Capitol on January 6th, you know, there's people on the right ready to go to war over things. And there are people on the left, Antifa, most notably in Portland and other places. There are people that would love to have a race war and just because they're not interested in fixing this problem. They're interested in using it to create chaos. And for some to go out and just kill people, whether it's white people you want to kill or whether it's black people you want to kill. And so my heart, even in the midst of all that we're talking about celebrating God's playfulness, I'm right in the middle of this, not only with a college in Amarillo, but with friends I know who are dealing with this from mostly the BIPOC side of it, people of color, blacks, indigenous, who really feel like there is a racism in our culture that many white people won't yet wrestle with. And one of the things I shared with the group I was with last week is that that was my life probably 10 years ago. I mean, it's a denial that's not, I don't want to see it. I don't want to look at it. I know it's there, but I want to ignore it because I'm on the side that gets what I want. It really is true, I think, that we don't recognize unfairness when we benefit from it. We recognize it when we're hurt by it. And that's what our black brothers and sisters have been telling us for a long time, that there is, and it's not just the police issues that go over and people get killed, George Floyd and others, Ahmaud Arbery, by people in the community. It's not just that it go, that's a big, that's the tip of the iceberg of it.
Yeah.
But it's the looks people get when they get in a room. It's when you try to apply for something and know you're qualified and don't get through. And it's not because necessarily there are white people overtly not wanting you to have a place in society. That is true in some places. But other times, just the fact that a lot of promotions, a lot of jobs are just given to relationships and connections, and it's who you know, not what you know. And so I'm more comfortable with that person on my staff because they look like me. And so I tend to look for more problems with that person who may be of color or some other reason why I wouldn't feel as comfortable with them. And those subtle things that we don't even notice. I was watching Hidden Figures the other day, which is the movie with Octavia Spencer and the mathematicians, the African-American women who were helping our astronauts get to orbit and eventually to the moon. And the white supervisor over Octavia Spencer just constantly just won't give her what she asks for. And she's very qualified and she just kind of keeps her down. And you get the idea she's being told that from above. So she's just acting in line with the systemic problem that's there at NASA. And at one point she says, you know, Dorothy, despite what you may think, I have nothing against y'all. And just the way it says it goes, oh, yeah, you do. But Octavia Spencer's answer was just so amazing. She said, I know. I know you probably believe that. And I think that's where many of us are. That's where I was 10 years ago. You kind of hope that civil rights legislation, it's in our Constitution, equal rights for everybody's got equal rights. Everybody has equal opportunity. It's in the law. So certainly it's in our society. And then when you begin to hear that it's not and that people stopped for traffic violations or stopped for whatever, they get treated very differently depending on the color of your skin and the place in the U.S. where you are. And that's not all cops. That only takes a small percentage of cops. That's not even most of them. I'm an advocate for law enforcement. I'm not a defund the police guy. I'm not any of that. But if we don't grow in our awareness that there is a problem, and that's kind of where I feel like, and for reasons I'll say kind of at the end of this, why I think that's important, I'm speaking up about it because I really think we need to take a look at it. And we need to listen to those who are saying there is a problem here. And we have a hard time doing that. We have a hard time waking up to the reality that there is a persistent problem by hearing the stories of people. But I like to tell people, all you gotta do is walk into, when we get back to restaurants or walk into a meeting at work where you are, notice how things change if it's a bunch of white people there and a black person walks in. Or watch how people are served differently if it's a white table with a white server and Hispanic or black people are in. And just when you begin to notice that there are differences, then that begins, that's a good thing. That begins to work in our heart. But you've got to be open to taking a look at it. We're being told There's a persistent problem, and that it's causing fear, it's causing resentment, it's causing the kind of thing that spills out into the street then as just anger. And I don't care what you, because you haven't cared what I've been feeling for 40 years. I don't care that you're afraid. I don't care what we destroy. I don't care, because there's that extreme. And it would help so much if people would just say, okay, we have a problem. There's a white preference in our culture. There just is. And there's white advantages. And if you can see that, then you can be part of dismantling it. Then you can be part of saying, no, we can't allow it. And I love this college, because they're wrestling with this. And we've got people in the room who are saying, it's not a problem here. We're fine. We don't do that. And you got other people in the room saying, oh, no, it's a problem here. We see it in various ways, not just with black, but with brown as well. And this is a very conservative community. So it's not one of those liberal enclaves going, yeah, we're going to take on anti-racism. It's a little community college saying, you know what, we do have a problem. And we want to make sure that this environment is fair for everybody who comes here. But getting people to bite into that awareness, that's not always easy. I remember not wanting to think about it. I want to believe that it's all fair out there. Because if it's not, then what am I doing just letting it happen and not being part of a solution?
Yeah, there's that piece of accountability where once you become aware of it, and especially relationally, you know, I would agree with you. Like, I, for a long time, it wasn't an overt, and I'm still growing in my understanding of this and the ways that I don't even see or don't even recognize. And yet, as I began to do life, I remember the first time that I really took a hard look at it as a result of relationship. And it was with my best friend, Marcos, and he's Puerto Rican. And at the time he had dreads, and, you know, he had tattoos on his arms and stuff. And we were living in a very conservative town in Wyoming, and he was my roommate, and he originally was from Chicago. And I was like, hey, when we were talking, what do we want to do for the afternoon? I was like, hey man, let's go target shooting. Have you guys ever gone target shooting before? And it was me and two Puerto Rican guys. And they both looked at me and they're like, no, we don't touch firearms. And I was like, what do you mean you don't touch firearms? He's like, well, if I touch a firearm and leave my fingerprint on it, somebody might commit a crime with it. And if I'm walking down the street and somebody sees me with a firearm in this town, they're probably going to pull me over and I'm going to get stopped. And I was giving them a hard time, because like we decided to do it and to go out into this BLM land out in the middle of nowhere where we wouldn't see anybody.
Is that what you mean by BLM? Black Lives Matter land?
No, Bureau of Land Management.
I just want to make sure people listening understood. Right? You're going to BLM land.
Bureau of Land Management. But they were literally like sneaking out to the car when I handed them a rifle that was in a gun bag. Because that was something that they never would do. And it was so, like, they had been trained all their life how to avoid that, because it could be misperceived by officers, by culture, by people around them. I just remember it being so impactful, because here were two guys that I trusted my life with, that I lived with, and yet I'd never seen it. I would never have even thought about that. And yet it was something that was very much a part of their reality that they had been trained in since they were little kids.
That's an advantage, obviously, we have as white people. The level of suspicion is a lot less for white people. The level of punishment, if you do get caught for something, a lot of white kids caught with pot, acid back in the day, turn it back to their parents, whatever. But they took kids, black kids, through the system and gave them a record. And then that makes it more difficult for them to advance anywhere else. So you can understand the frustration that's there, that they're just treated differently. And it's not necessarily, this is what I try to get people to understand, it's not necessarily overt racism. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, in fact, when black people talk about racism, they're mostly talking about impact. I've noticed when white people are talking about racism, they're mostly talking about intention. And I'm not racist. I'm colorblind. I see everybody the same. I don't. And they mean it. They genuinely mean it. And yet they don't see that what's being talked about is not your intent. Because racist is the worst thing you can be called as a white person. No one wants to be called, except unless you're Ku Klux Klan, obviously. But or white supremacist. No one wants to be called a racist. You don't want to believe that you're racist. You want to believe that you treat people fairly.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it's not necessarily our intentions that close doors, but it's the impact of a society that's weighted toward people who are white and have all the connections of people that are white and navigate life with less suspicion than black people. And yet oftentimes we want to, it's George Floyd or whatever. Well, they were on drugs or they were doing this or they were doing that. So it justifies whatever extreme measures were used to restrain. Like you make a mistake, well, then you get whatever you want. Well, if it happened to a few white kids in our neighborhoods, I think we would understand what other parents are feeling. There's one of my favorite emails I've got talking about this. I know not everybody loves the God journey when I talk about race these days. They just want to turn it off because they like not thinking about it. But this is what this one doctor wrote me. He said, your book on polarization with Arnita and Bob really changed my thinking. Last year after George Floyd was killed, I decided to take a few moments with my black patients during the end of their appointments and ask them how they were doing in light of what's happened. It was difficult to do given my schedule and how I can easily get behind, but it was worth it. I probably listened to 25 or so patients, and it was remarkable that nearly all of them had personal stories about their negative experiences with law enforcement or one of their family members. My goal was to listen and learn. I don't think I would have even thought of doing this had it not been for reading your book. And that doesn't, you know, I know I've got good friends in law enforcement. One of my best friends here is in law enforcement. I'm not down on law enforcement. They've got a tough job, even tougher now that the world doesn't support them. That's why I think it's incumbent on them to get the bad people out, the people that are, that dominate people racially, that fecalize a white person. Man, you got to do what I tell you or I'm going to come down hard on you. Those kinds of people have to be gotten out of the system. But I love that he was able to, you know what, I'm going to change my approach here to people of color in my office, and I'm going to ask them what they're going through and listen to their stories. If we could do that with people that we know, people at work, just ask people if you know them well enough to say, would you mind telling me your story, what you face? There are people who listen to the God Journey, and I get emails after this that love the fact that we're talking about this and loving the fact as African-Americans that we are talking about it and that people are becoming more responsive. And unfortunately, it's way too slow, way too late. I get that. I wish I would been in a different space about this 40 years ago. But growing up where I grew up, it just wasn't something I was tuned into. And particularly in California, there's not a lot of overt racism out here. There isn't. It's not like the South. It's not like, you know, going out and lynchings and all the thing that the South does and all the dishonesty that goes on there. It's not the same in California. And yet every black person I've talked to can give me stories about looks they get when they walk in a room, about what relationships are open to them and which are not, about advantages white people have around them. Now, some black people who are talented enough and whatever enough overcome that? Very few do.
Yeah.
And that's often used as an excuse to say, well, if they could, then everybody can. That's not true. And if you get to know some people and ask that, you'll figure it out. And this doesn't have to be you have bad intentions. It's just, could we see that our society is unfair in one direction? And if we can see that it's unfair, then what can we do to make it fair? So that no one's skin color should affect their access or opportunity in the society. And if you do that, the second thing, it's kind of a series of things I worked through with this group. Yeah. One was denial. I was talking to the white people in the room. Anti-racism is really a work for white people. If black people could have fixed it by now, don't you think they would have? They could fix it without us? Yes. We're the ones that's not always opening the doors that needs to be opened. So if there's denial and you grow an awareness that maybe there is a problem, then the next thing that just naturally happens is empathy. You're going to care about people you know who encounter unfairness. And if you can listen to those stories and hold them, and don't disbelieve them and don't try to just, oh, that's not what really happened there. That, you know, not try to muck with it. Just listen and believe them. Then you're going to come out in a different space where you're going to have some empathy. And with that empathy, here's what I got to tell people. You've got to stay focused. The people who want to start a race war here, or even people who are on either side of this that are not in the race war end of it, but just passionate about their point of view, there are extremes on both left and right that if you focus on the extremists, then you can discount the problem, right? If you can say, well, look at Black Lives Matter. They're a Marxist organization, and they are the organization. They want to move toward Marxism, and there's reasons for that. No, I don't support any of that. But the basic plea of Black Lives Matter, society is skewed unfairly. Will you help us fix that? That's where you got to keep your eyes, because the extremists on both sides are trying to deflect the real issue by critical race theory, talking about reparations, devaluing white heritage, focusing on black on black crime to ignore racism. That's what whites do, typical deflections. And I even heard this from a friend who said to me about the podcast, he said, you know what? I think you and I are absolutely one about racial equality, but I think we really disagree on equity. And I was really surprised, because I wouldn't think this guy and I would have any difference on equity. So I said, tell me where you see our difference in equity. He said, well, equity is equal outcome. So two people have the same job and one's working hard and one's not, you give them the same amount of pay. And I said, that's equity to you? That's not equity. And then he sent me an article by the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank. And it says equality is what we have under the Constitution and the law. Everyone's equal. That's just true. Equity is that people want the same results, I don't think that's what equity means at all. Equity means having the same opportunity, not just having something in the law that says you have equal opportunity. The equity is I actually have equal opportunity. It's not equal outcomes. He said, well, according to this, it is. And I thought, you know what? This is what this conservative think tank has done. It's defined equity in a way that now you've got a bunch of conservatives saying, I'm against racial equity. Now, how is that going to help solve the problem? It's just not. If you're against racial equity, even if you're using say I'm for equal opportunity and not equal outcomes. Say it that way, fine. People will understand that. But just to say you're against racial equity, oh my gosh, those are the voices who want to have a fight here.
Yeah.
Not my friend. He's believed this definition. So now he's got to push back against the whole idea that there's racism in America, because what he's saying is all that is a Marxist undertow to get us to change the base of the nation. And I'll say, hey, there are people on the extreme left that want that to happen. I agree. But for that reason, you can't miss-see the fact that we've still got a lot of work to do to get to equity in America. And equity, you can have equal rights, but if you don't have equal opportunity, then your equal rights don't mean a whole lot. You have always got to litigate to fight for them. And I think what black people are looking for more than let's change all that, become Marxist, the people of color that I know, what they want are allies. They want people in the white community who can just stand with them and call out racism when they see it, and help them find and help them get to the table where they're not at the table, help them be in conversations they're not in pools of relationships that will help them grow and give them more connections. Because it shouldn't matter what color a person is. That's the goal. It shouldn't matter. But we're hearing from African-Americans, Hispanics, and others that it does matter.
Yeah.
That it's not equal. And so I hope we can become a voice for that. That's all it means. Doesn't mean you have to become a Marxist. Doesn't mean you want to change the whole nature of the government. Doesn't mean any of that. Just means I want equal opportunity that goes with the equality we have in the Constitution.
Yeah.
Be careful how you use words, because everybody's trying to manipulate the words to keep up the conflict. That's how they raise money, remember. And then the final thing we talked about is when you can move through denial to awareness, awareness to empathy, empathy to keep your focus when other people are trying to draw you off the mark and say, it's this bigger issue. Let's just get back to, is it equal? And if it's not equal, what can we do about it? And the final thing is to speak up, which is partly what I've done on the podcast and blog that stick people off. It's what I've done in Language of Healing. It's to actually begin to speak to the people I know, saying, we've got work to do.
Yeah.
And hopefully you'll join us. And if you don't want to join us, if you don't want to be an ally, if you want to just pretend our society treats everybody equally, I agree that that's the ideal. I don't agree that's the pragmatics right now. So you speak up when you invite people to a table or engage them relationally. That's one way to speak up. You speak up with majority culture friends who are still at step one. And I know some of my friends don't appreciate. I was with a guy the other day who was real upset about something the government was doing about equity. And I challenged him on it. And he just looked at me and said, I don't ever want to discuss equity with you. I know what I believe. And he would be like some other friends. He believes that equality exists already in America. And equity is for special favors instead of, no, it's still trying to level the playing field, level the advantages. So I don't mind speaking. I said that won't be the last time we talk about it, but I'm not interested in badgering you. I'm interested in people I talk to who are still at step one. How do I give you an on-ramp to some thinking about racial issues that might help you be more aware? I'm not trying to provide you an off-ramp and be annoying and obnoxious and bring it up all the time and just create more anxiety in your heart about it. So you speak up when your majority culture friends are still at step one. You speak up when you witness racism. And I've done that just to, and you can do it gently. You don't have to go, you're racist. That's never going to help. But sometimes you can just ask a question. Somebody's, you know, making a joke that's a little, say, you know what? Given all that's going on in America, you think that's really funny? You just have to ask the question. And they'll defend themselves. Almost always people, no, don't start that, blah, blah. But they'll think about it later.
Yeah.
Because I hear them come back to me later going, you know what? I appreciated you saying that because I think, and or others in the conversation will say, man, I wanted to say something. I'm so glad you did.
And that's like our need of firing the rubber bullets, right?
Yeah. If she keeps some rubber, sometimes they're not rubber, but it is. It's being willing to speak up. And then institutionally, whether at work, whether if you're in education, whether whatever. Now, I know people are concerned that critical race theory is mandated in California schools and parents are pulling their kids out. Critical race theory is a deterrent to getting where we need to get to. I know not all black people are going to love that statement, but it is. It's so extremist to devalue white culture, to everybody's a racist, to all that language are off-ramps. They're exactly the opposite of what I'm talking about. They're off-ramps to people in the dominant culture. They're like, okay, I'm not that way. I don't feel that way. I'm not going that way. Instead of, you know what? We've got to have a more reasoned conversation with people who take it seriously. Now, I understand why black people are really frustrated that in 40 years of trying to get us to have this conversation, we haven't had it. I get why they want to push the extremes, because maybe you don't move the needle all the way that far, but you at least move it from where it is now. But the hostility behind it in the long term is going to negate the impact of it.
Yeah.
I think the momentum right now is more people are awake to the problem. So if we can take that awareness and channel it into positive change, we're going to be better off than if we have a race war or keep pushing for these extremist views that turn off people going, no, I'm not that kind of person. Yeah. And no, I don't want my kids to go through that kind of curriculum. And so there's going to be great resistance to it. It only builds the animosity. So some cooler heads need to prevail. Somewhere in here, a language of healing for a polarized nation.
Yes.
That's why we wrote that, man. There's a better conversation to be had. Don't be distracted by the extremes left and right. There's a better conversation to be had when reasoned people recognize that there's still some unfairness in our culture. I watched that PBS show someone referred to me, The Black Church.
Mm.
Which, oh my gosh, if you haven't seen it, there's a website. You can go there and get it. It's an amazing story of even back to the slave days when there was discussions at high levels of whether we would give the gospel to the slave because it would encourage their freedom. If they really understood the gospel, they wouldn't make good slaves. And so even when they brought the gospel to black people, they changed the Bible to take out verses about freedom so it wouldn't become a problem. And then when they wanted to have black churches, we wanted to stop them from having it because we wanted to control the message. And just if you want to get how systemic it is, even in Christianity, and why there's a black church and a white church in America, I never understood all those dynamics until I watched that series. And it was eye-opening.
And that's on PBS?
It was on PBS, on a website. I'll put a link to it at the bottom of the podcast here so people can go see it. Yeah, it was... It was awesome. And there's great music the whole time. There's just great music undergirding it. But you really see, particularly if you grew up in California or some state where you're not part of that South and that same heritage, when you go back to that, you can see why in states like that, why the problem still persists and why it's not so easy just to say, oh, hey, let's all have multicultural churches, because so much behind it and how the church became the place where slaves could have connection, have a sense of freedom, grow in that conversation with each other. They even said this. I didn't know this was true, but at the in the midst of the Civil War, as it was ramping up, whatever, President Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, met with black church leaders. And his proposal to them was, if we do the emancipation and you guys are free, we're going to need to send you back to Africa. You'll never be able to live here as free people. Mm. So would you guys be open to all the black people going back to Africa? And the black leader said, are you kidding us? Mm. We were born here. Yeah. Our families have been here for 200 years. What do you mean we're going to go back to Africa? We have nothing in Africa, nothing to go back to. And that was a wake-up call for President Lincoln going, oh, yeah, this is a bigger deal. But when you see all that systemic stuff, it makes it easier to understand why in economics, in religion, in politics, there's just a skewed advantage to the white person. And it's just gotten so wearied for black people. They want our help to fix it. Yeah. And I'm in.
Yeah.
So we're going back to help them do that.
I had a similar encounter. I haven't seen the black church yet, but I actually watched the trial of the Chicago Seven on Netflix.
Yeah, I saw that too. Yeah.
Ooh. And the way that they treat the black character that was in that trial, and not allowing him representation, and just, it was awful. Like, it just, man, it just turns your stomach, you know. And I don't know how accurate that depiction was, but I know they tried to be fairly historically accurate. And man, it again just points to that, and the systemic and how long it's been taking place.
It's not always so incredibly overt in most places in our lives, but there's enough of it to at least ask God, do I need to be open to seeing things I'm not seeing?
Yeah.
And if you're open to that and seeing some stuff, and then if you are seeing it, where do I speak out? Where do I, you know, and everybody doesn't have to grab a bully pulpit and come up on a soapbox and do whatever. But if you just speak up where you are in your neighborhood, where you see mistreatment, where you see unequal treatment, and be a voice to help fix it. And I know it's difficult right now. I know it feels like, boy, to care about this, I'm going to have to become a Marxist. It's not true.
Yeah.
Don't listen to the rhetoric on either side of this thing. Keep your eye on the prize. There's brothers and sisters who want our help reaching a real equality and wrestling with some of the unequal things. When World War II veterans come back from World War II and white people have GI Bill and housing opportunities that was denied to black people, that yeah. was overtly denied to black soldiers. And then that, for so many families, was a turning point coming out of the Depression. They could own land. They could own a house. They had help with an education. That changed the economic trajectory of their family for generations. Mm-hmm. And people who didn't have those same opportunities, it also affected the trajectory of their lives in ways that then we look at now and say, well, if you worked harder, if you did this, and it's just not fair. That kind of perspective is not fair, or that all black people should be treated with more suspicion than all white people, or however that comes and plays out in your heart, that's something you and Jesus get to tackle together. And I think Jesus cares about this a whole lot. And not everyone's going to respond the same way. Not everyone needs to. It's just an opportunity to be aware. And be aware gives the Holy Spirit an opportunity to work. I don't know. Those voices need to be out there, because it's difficult that they're not.
I think the best way to really connect with that is like the risk that your friend the doctor took of taking the time to have the courage to pause and ask a question.
I love that.
Because I think it has to come in the context of relationship. If I didn't have friends that were black, if I didn't have friends that were in the Latino culture, if I didn't have friends that were in the LGBTQ culture, I wouldn't know. You know, I would have an external perspective, and I still have an external perspective. But due to relationship with those individuals, my awareness has started to open up, and it wasn't in a threatening way. It was in the context of relationship, and it drew me into, oh, wow, why is that? And they had the courage to say, well, you haven't ever seen that before. It's like, no, I haven't. And so then it's like, okay, then let's explore it. Let me show you, let me give you a snippet of my lens.
And that's so helpful,
man. I just feel like it has to come in the context of that relationship. And even if it's taking the courage, just to step out and start pursuing a friendship with somebody who isn't exactly like you or I.
Especially for those of us who claim allegiance to Jesus Christ, who is our brother, who was not white like us, no matter how you want to categorize it, who really want us to know that from every tribe and tongue and people and nation, God's assembling a people to show the world who he is. Mm-hmm. And that's just not Christians of color. That's caring about everyone of color and caring about people who have it differently in the world than we do. And yes, trying to find equitable ways to fix the problem. It's going to take us years and decades. It's not going to happen easily, but I do think there needs to be progress, or we are headed for the explosion of a frustration that is not going to be denied any longer.
Yeah.
And I hear it, man. If I was in that part of the body of Christ that just felt persistently marginalized, unacknowledged, and unresponded to, that would be incredibly painful, wouldn't it?
So do you think that, Wayne, that we'll see a race war in our time?
Oof. My gut would tell me no, but I think that there's a conditional sense of that. If we don't take this seriously, there are people who are trying to start a race war who can tap the frustration of people who feel persistently ignored. So my thought is we're a better country than that, and we'll find a way through this. I'm hopeful that we will.
Yeah.
But you know what? When the end of the age comes, all kinds of stuff happens. So who knows?
What do you think the direction or a goal of a race war is? Like, I understand the deep frustration, the long-seated pain, the anger of not being heard, but then where does it go?
Well, the race war isn't about that, right? The race war is there's groups of people that want to basically change the nature of the United States. Mm-hmm. And destruction of the status quo then allows, the white extremists are going to want one thing on one side. The black extremists are going to want more Marxist communist government on the other side. So that's where it seems to be at the moment, at least by the rhetoric. So they're not really, ultimately, I know this is weird to say, for them, race is just a tool. It's not the objective. Mm-hmm. It's the tool to get something else they want. If we can get back to, man, let's fix this. And I think it's a good momentum in our culture right now to fix this. I'm hopeful that if we can give it the space it needs right now and really fix the problems that are being caused, that'll be a good thing for all of us. But there's always forces trying to undermine government as it is because somebody wants to be in power. I mean, that's the revolution in China that, always happens, unfortunately. So hopefully we can learn, and in learning, become more compassionate in the world and more generous and look and learn. I guess that's the bottom line. Look and learn and see what you figure out. And don't trust the media to tell you how you should respond to these things, including this media.
Yeah.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.